St. Thomas Aquinas by Gilbert Keith Chesterton, published 1933. Introductory note. This book makes no pretense to be anything but a popular sketch of a great historical character who ought to be more popular. Its aim will be achieved if it leads those who have hardly even heard of St. Thomas Aquinas to read about him in better books. But from this necessary limitation, certain consequences follow, which should perhaps be allowed for from the start. First, it follows that the tale is told very largely to those who are not of the communion of St. Thomas, and who may be interested in him as I might be in Confucius or Muhammad. Yet, on the other hand, the very need of presenting a clean-cut outline involved its cutting into other outlines of thought among those who may think differently. If I write a sketch of Nelson mainly for foreigners, I may have to explain elaborately many things that all Englishmen know, and possibly cut out, for brevity, many details that many Englishmen would like to know. But, on the other side, it would be difficult to write a very vivid and moving narrative of Nelson, while entirely concealing the fact that he fought with the French. It would be futile to make a sketch of St. Thomas and conceal the fact that he fought with heretics. And yet the fact itself may embarrass the very purpose for which it is employed. I can only express the hope, and indeed the confidence, that those who regard me as the heretic will hardly blame me for expressing my own convictions, and certainly not for expressing my hero's convictions. There is only one point upon which such a question concerns this very simple narrative. It is the conviction, which I have expressed once or twice in the course of it, that the 16th century schism was really a belated revolt of the 13th century pessimists. It was a backwash of the old Augustinian Puritanism against the Aristotelian liberality. Without that, I could not place my historical figure in history. But the whole is meant only for a rough sketch of a figure in a landscape, and not of a landscape with figures. Second, it follows that in any such simplification, I can hardly say much of the philosopher beyond showing that he had a philosophy. I have only, so to speak, given examples of that philosophy. Lastly, it follows that it is practically impossible to deal adequately with the theology. A lady I know picked up a book of selections from St. Thomas with a commentary, and began hopefully to read a section with the innocent heading, "The Simplicity of God." She then laid down the book with a sigh and said, "Well, if that's his simplicity, I wonder what his complexity is like." With all respect to that excellent Thomistic commentary, I have no desire to have this book laid down, at the very first glance, with a similar sigh. I have taken the view that the biography is an introduction to the philosophy, and that the philosophy is an introduction to the theology, and that I can only carry the reader just beyond the first stage of the story. Third, I have not thought it necessary to notice those critics who, from time to time, desperately play to the gallery by reprinting paragraphs of medieval demonology in the hope of horrifying the modern public merely by an unfamiliar language. I have taken it for granted that educated men know that Aquinas and all his contemporaries and all his opponents for centuries after did believe in demons and similar facts, but I have not thought them worth mentioning here, for the simple reason that they do not help to detach or distinguish the portrait. In all that, there was no disagreement between Protestant or Catholic theologians, for all the hundreds of years during which there was any theology, and St. Thomas is not notable as holding such views, except in holding them rather mildly. I have not discussed such matters, not because I have any reason to conceal them, but because they do not in any way personally concern the one person whom it is here my business to reveal. There is hardly room, even as it is, for such a figure in such a frame. Chapter 1. On Two Friars. Let me at once anticipate comment by answering to the name of that notorious character who rushes in where even the angels of the angelic doctor might fear to tread. Some time ago I wrote a little book of this type and shape on St. Francis of Assisi, and some time after, I do not when or how, as the song says, and certainly not why, I promised to write a book of the same size, or the same smallness, on St. Thomas Aquinas. The promise was Franciscan only in its rashness, and the parallel was very far from being Thomistic in its logic. You can make a sketch of St. Francis. You could only make a plan of St. Thomas, like the plan of a labyrinthine city. And yet, in a sense, he would fit into a much larger picture, or a much smaller book. What did we really know of his life might be fairly dealt with in a few pages, for he did not, like St. Francis, disappear in a shower of personal anecdotes and popular legends. What we know, or could know, or may eventually have the luck to learn, of his work will probably fill even more libraries in the future than it has filled in the past. It was allowable to sketch St. Francis in an outline, but with St. Thomas everything depends on the filling up of the outline. It was even medieval in a manner to illuminate a miniature of the Poverello, whose very title is diminutive. But to make a digest, in the tabloid manner, of the dumb ox of Sicily passes all digestive experiments in the matter of an ox in a teacup. But we must hope it is possible to make an outline of biography, now that anybody seems capable of writing a story of history or an outline of anything. Only in the present case the outline is rather an outsize. The gown that could contain the colossal friar is not kept in stock. I have said that these can only be portraits in outline, but the concrete contrast is here so striking that even if we actually saw the two human figures in outline coming over the hill in their friar's gowns, we could not find that contrast even comic. It would be like seeing, even from afar, the silhouettes of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, or of Falstaff and Master Slender. Saint Francis was a lean and lively little man, thin as a thread and vibrant as a bowstring, and his motions like an arrow from the bow. All his life was a series of plunges and scampers, darting after the beggar, dashing naked into the woods, tossing himself into the strange ship, hurling himself into the sultan tent, and offering to hurl himself into the fire. In appearance he must have really been like a thin brown skeleton autumn leaf, dancing eternally before the wind. But in truth, it was that he was the wind. St. Thomas was a huge, heavy bull of a man, fat and slow and quiet, very mild and magnanimous, but not very sociable, shy even apart from the humility of holiness, and abstracted even apart from his occasional and carefully concealed experiences of trance or ecstasy. St. Francis was so fiery and even fidgety that the ecclesiastics, whom before he appeared quite suddenly, thought he was a madman. St. Thomas was so stolid that the scholars in the schools which he attended regularly thought he was a dunce. Indeed, he was the sort of schoolboy, not unknown, who would much rather be thought a dunce than have his own dreams invaded by more active or animated dunces. This external contrast extends to almost every point in the two personalities. It was the paradox of St. Francis that while he was passionately fond of poems, he was rather distrustful of books. It was the outstanding fact about St. Thomas that he loved books and lived on books, that he lived the very life of the clerk or scholar in the Canterbury Tales, who would rather have 100 books of Aristotle and his philosophy than any wealth the world could give him. When asked for what he thanked God most, he answered simply, "I have understood every page I ever read." St. Francis was very vivid in his poems and rather vague in his documents. St. Thomas devoted his whole life to documenting whole systems of pagan and Christian literature, and occasionally wrote a hymn like a man taking a holiday. They saw the same problem from different angles, of simplicity and subtlety. St. Francis thought it would be enough to pour out his heart to the Mohammedans, to persuade them not to worship Mahound. St. Thomas bothered his head with every hair-splitting distinction and deduction about the absolute or the accident, merely to prevent them from misunderstanding Aristotle. St. Francis was the son of a shopkeeper, or middle-class trader, and his whole life was a revolt against the mercantile life of his father. He retained, nonetheless, something of the quickness and social adaptability which makes the market hum like a hive. In the common phrase, fond as he was of green fields, he did not let the grass grow under his feet. He was what American millionaires and gangsters call a live wire. It is typical of the mechanistic moderns that, even when they try to imagine a live thing, they can only think of a mechanical metaphor from a dead thing. There is such a thing as a live worm, but there is no such thing as a live wire. St. Francis would have heartily agreed that he was a worm, but that he was very live worm. the greatest of all foes to go getting ideal. He had certainly abandoned getting, but he was still going. St. Thomas, on the other hand, came out of a world where he might have enjoyed leisure, and he remained one of those men whose labor has something of the placidity of leisure. He was a hard worker, but nobody could possibly mistake him for a hustler. He had something indefinable about him, which marks those whose work when they need not work. For he was by birth a gentleman of a great house, and such repose can remain as a habit when it is no longer a motive. But in him it was expressed only in its most amiable elements. For instance, there was possibly something of it in his effortless courtesy and patience. Every saint is a man before he is a saint, and a saint may be made of every sort or kind of man. And most of us will choose between these two different types according to our different tastes. But I will confess that, while the romantic glory of St. Francis has lost nothing of its glamour for me, I have in later years grown to feel almost as much affection, or even some aspects even more, for this man who unconsciously inhabited a large heart and a large head, like one inheriting a large house, and exercised there an equally generous, if rather more absent-minded, hospitality. There are moments when St. Francis, the most unworldly man who ever walked the world, was almost too efficient for me. St. Thomas Aquinas has recently reappeared in the culture of the colleges and the salons in a way that would have been quite startling even 10 years ago, and the mood that has concentrated on him is doubtless the very different from which popularized St. Francis quite 20 years ago. The saint is a medicine because he is an antidote. Indeed, that is why the saint is often a martyr. He is mistaken for a poison because he is an antidote. He will generally be found restoring the world to sanity by exaggerating whatever the world neglects, which is by no means always the same element in every age. Yet each generation seeks its saint by instinct, and he is not what the people want, but rather what the people need. This is certainly the very much mistaken meaning of the words of the first saints, "Ye are the salt of the earth," which caused the ex-Kaiser to remark with all solemnity that his beefy Germans were the salt of the earth, meaning thereby merely that they were the earth's beefiest and therefore the best. But salt seasons and preserves beef, not because it is like beef, but because it is very unlike it. Christ did not tell his apostles that they were only the excellent people, but that they were exceptional people, the permanently incongruous and incompatible people. And the text about the salt of the earth is really as sharp and shrewd and tart as the taste of salt. Because they were the exceptional people, that they must not lose their exceptional quality. If salt loses its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? Is a much more pointed question than any mere lament over the price of the best beef. If the world grows too worldly, it can be rebuked by the church. But if the church grows too worldly, it cannot be adequately rebuked for worldliness by the world. Therefore, it is the paradox of history that each generation is converted by the saint who contradicts it most. Saint Francis had a curious and almost uncanny attraction for the Victorians. For the 19th century English, who seemed superficially to be the most complacent about their commerce and their common sense. Not only a rather complacent Englishman like Matthew Arnold, but even the English liberals whom he criticized for their complacency, began slowly to discover the mystery of the Middle Ages through the strange story told in Feathers and Flames in the hagiographical pictures of Giotto. There was something in the story of St. Francis that pierced through all those English qualities which are most famous and fatuous. To all those English qualities which are most hidden and human, the secret softness of heart, the poetical vagueness of mind, the love of landscape and of animals, St. Francis of Assisi was the only medieval Catholic who really became popular in England on his own merits. It was largely because of a subconscious feeling that the modern world had neglected those particular merits. The English middle classes found their only missionary in the figure, which all types in the world they most despised, an Italian beggar. So, as the 19th century clutched at the Franciscan romance, precisely because it had neglected romance, so the 20th century is already clutching at the Thomist rational theology because it has neglected reason. In a world that was too stolid, Christianity returned in the form of a vagabond. In a world that was grown a great deal too wild, Christianity has returned in the form of a teacher of logic. In the world of Herbert Spencer, men wanted a cure for indigestion. In the world of Einstein, they want a cure for vertigo. In the first case, they dimly perceived the fact that it was long after a fast that St. Francis sang the song of the sun and the praise of the fruitful earth. In the second case, they already dimly perceived that, even if they want only to understand Einstein, it is necessary first to understand the use of the understanding. They begin to see that, as the 18th century thought itself the age of reason, and the 19th century thought itself the age of common sense, the 20th century cannot as yet even managed to think of itself anything but the age of uncommon nonsense. In those conditions, the world needs a saint, but above all, it needs a philosopher. And these two cases do show that the world, to do it justice, had an instinct for what it needs. The earth was really very flat, for those Victorians who most vigorously repeated that it was round, and Alverno of the Stigmata stood up as a single mountain in the plain. But the earth is an earthquake, a ceaseless and apparently endless earthquake, for the moderns, for whom Newton has been scrapped along with Ptolemy. And for them there is something more steep and even incredible than a mountain. A piece of really solid ground, the level of the level-headed man. Thus in our time the two saints have appealed to two generations, an age of romantics and an age of skeptics. Yet in their own age they were doing the same work, a work that has changed the world. Again, it may be said truly that the comparison is idle, and does not fit in well, even as a fancy. Since the men were not properly even of the same generation, or of the same historic moment, if two friars were to be presented as a pair of heavenly twins, the obvious comparison is between St. Francis and St. Dominic. The relations of St. Francis and St. Thomas were, at nearest, those of uncle and nephew. And my fanciful excursus may appear only a highly profane version of "Tommy, make room for your uncle." For if St. Francis and St. Dominic were the great twin brethren, Thomas was obviously the first great son of St. Dominic, as was his friend Bonaventure of St. Francis. Nevertheless, I have reason, indeed two reasons, for taking as a text the accident of two title pages, and putting St. Thomas beside St. Francis, instead of pairing him off with Bonaventure, the Franciscan. It is because the comparison, remote and perverse as it may seem, is really a sort of shortcut to the heart of history, and brings about us the most rapid route to the real question of the life and work of St. Thomas Aquinas. For most people now have a rough but picturesque picture in their minds of the life and story of St. Francis of Assisi, and the shortest way of telling the other story is to say that, while the two men were thus a contrast in almost every feature, they were really doing the same thing. One of them was doing it in the world of the mind, and the other in the world of the worldly. But it was the same great medieval movement, but still little understood. In a constructive sense, it was more important than the Reformation. Nay, in a constructive sense, it was the Reformation. About this medieval movement, there are two facts that must first be emphasized. They are not, of course, contrary facts, but they are perhaps answers to contrary fallacies. First, in spite of all that was once said about superstition, the Dark Ages and the sterility of scholasticism, it was in every sense a movement of enlargement, always moving towards greater light and even greater liberty. Second, in spite of all that was said later on about the progress and the Renaissance and the forerunners of modern thought, it was almost entirely a movement of orthodox theological enthusiasm, unfolded from within. It was not a compromise with the world, or a surrender to heathens or heretics, or even a mere borrowing of external aids, even when it did borrow them. Insofar as it did reach out to the light of common day, it was like the action of a plant by which its force thrusts out its leaves into the sun, not like the action of one who merely lets daylight into a prison. In short, it was what is technically called a development in doctrine. But there seems to be a queer ignorance, not only about the technical, but the natural meaning of the word development. The critics of Catholic theology seem to suppose that it is not so much an evolution as an evasion, that it is, at best, an adaptation. They fancy that its very success is the success of surrender, but that is not the natural meaning of the word development. When we talk of a child being well developed, we mean that he has grown bigger and stronger with his own strength, not that he is padded with borrowed pillows or walks on stilts to make him look taller. When we say that a puppy develops into a dog, We do not mean that his growth is a gradual compromise with a cat. We mean that he becomes more doggy and not less. Development is the expansion of all the possibilities and implications of a doctrine, as there is time to distinguish them and draw them out. And the point here is that the enlargement of medieval theology was simply the full comprehension of that theology. It is of primary importance to realize this fact first, about the time of the great Dominican and the first Franciscan, because their tendency, humanistic and naturalistic in a hundred ways, was truly the development of the supreme doctrine, which also the dogma of all dogmas. It is in this that the popular poetry of St. Francis and the almost rationalistic prose of St. Thomas appear most vividly as part of the same movement. There are both great growths of Catholic development, depending upon external things only as every living and growing thing depends on them. That is, it digests and transforms them, but continues in its own image and not in theirs. A Buddhist or a communist might dream of two things which simultaneously eat each other as the perfect form of unification. But it is not so with living things. St. Francis was content to call himself the troubadour of God, but not content with the God of the troubadours. St. Thomas did not reconcile Christ to Aristotle. He reconciled Aristotle to Christ. Yes, in spite of the contrast that they are as conspicuous and even comic as the comparison between the fat man and the thin man, the tall man and the short, in spite of the contrast between the vagabond and the student, between the apprentice and the aristocrat, between the book hater and the book lover, between the wildest of all missionaries and the mildest of all professors, the great fact of medieval history is that these two great men were doing the same great work, one in the study and the other in the street. They were not bringing something new into Christianity, in the sense of something heathen or heretical into Christianity. On the contrary, they were bringing Christianity into Christendom, but they were bringing it back against the pressure of certain historical tendencies, which had hardened into habits in so many great schools and authorities in the Christian Church, that they were using tools and weapons which seemed to many people to be associated with heresy or heathenry. St. Francis used nature as much as St. Thomas used Aristotle, and to some they seemed to be using a pagan goddess and a pagan sage. What they were really doing, and especially what St. Thomas was really doing, will form the main matter of these pages. But it is convenient to be able to compare him from the first with a more popular saint, because we may thus sum up the substance of it in the most popular way. Perhaps it would sound too paradoxical to say that these two saints saved us from spirituality, a dreadful doom. Perhaps it may be misunderstood if I say that St. Francis, for all his love of animals, saved us from being Buddhists, and that St. Thomas, for all his love of Greek philosophy, saved us from being Platonists. But it is best to say the truth in its simplest form, that they both reaffirmed the incarnation by bringing God back to earth. This analogy, which may seem rather remote, is really perhaps the best practical preface to the philosophy of St. Thomas. As we shall have to consider more closely later on, the purely spiritual or mystical side of Catholicism had very much got the upper hand in the first Catholic centuries. Through the genius of Augustine, who had been a Platonist, and perhaps never ceased to be a Platonist, through the transcendentalism of the supposed work of the Areopagite, through the Oriental trend of the later empire and something Asiatic about the almost pontifical knighthood of Byzantium, and all these things weighed down what we should now roughly call the Western element, though it has as good a right to be called the Christian element, since its common sense is but the holy familiarity of the world made flesh. Anyhow, it must suffice for the moment to say that theologians had somewhat stiffened into a sort of Platonic pride in their possession of intangible and untranslatable truths within, as if no part of their wisdom had any root anywhere in the real world. Now, the first thing that Aquinas did, though by no means the last, was to say to these pure transcendentalists something substantially like this: "Far be it from a poor friar to deny that you have these dazzling diamonds in your head, all designed in the most perfect mathematical shapes and shining with a purely celestial light, all there, almost before you begin to think, let alone to see or hear or feel. But I am not ashamed to say that I find my reason fed by my senses, that I owe a great deal of what I think to what I see, and smell and taste and handle, and that so far as my reason is concerned, I feel obliged to treat all this reality as real. To be brief, in all humility, I do not believe that God meant man to exercise only that peculiar, uplifted and abstracted sort of intellect which you are so fortunate as to possess. But I believe that there is a middle field of facts which are given by the senses to be the subject matter of the reason, and that in that field the reason has a right to rule as the representative of God in man. It is true that all this is lower than the angels, but it is higher than the animals and all the actual material objects man finds around him. True, man also can be an object, even a deplorable object, but what man has done, man may do. And if an antiquated old heathen called Aristotle can help me to do it, I will thank him in all humility." Thus began what is commonly called the appeal to Aquinas and Aristotle. It might be called the appeal to reason and the authority of the senses, and it will be obvious that there is a sort of popular parallel to it in the fact that St. Francis did not only listen for the angels, but also listen to the birds. And before we come to those aspects of St. Thomas that were very severely intellectual, we may note that in him, as in St. Francis, there is a preliminary practical element which is rather moral, of a sort of good and straightforward humility, and a readiness in the man to regard even himself in some ways as an animal, as St. Francis compared his body to a donkey. It may be said that the contrast holds everywhere, even in zoological metaphor, that if St. Francis was like that common or garden donkey who carried Christ into Jerusalem, St. Thomas, who was actually compared to an ox, rather resembled that apocalyptic monster of almost Assyrian mystery, the winged bull. But again, we must not let all that can be contrasted eclipse what was common, or forget that neither of them would have been too proud to wait as patiently as the ox and ass in the stable of Bethlehem. There were, of course, as we shall soon see, many other much more curious and complicated ideas in the philosophy of St. Thomas. Besides this primary idea of a central common sense that is nourished by the five senses, but at this stage the point of the story is not that this was a Thomist doctrine, but that it is a great and eminently Christian doctrine. For upon this modern writers write a great deal of nonsense, and show more than their normal ingenuity in missing the point. Having assumed without argument, at the start, that all emancipation must lead men away from religion and towards irreligion, they have just blankly and blindly forgotten what is the outstanding feature of the religion itself. It will not be possible to conceal much longer from anybody the fact that St. Thomas Aquinas was one of the great liberators of the human intellect. The sectarians of the 17th or 18th century were essentially obscurantists, and they guarded an obscurantist legend that the schoolman was an obscurantist. This was wearing thin even in the 19th century. It will be impossible in the 20th. It has nothing to do with the truth of their theology or his, but only with the truth of historical proportion, which begins to reappear as quarrels begin to die down, simply as one of the facts that bulk big in history. It is true to say that Thomas was a very great man who reconciled religion with reason, who expanded it towards experimental science, who insisted that the senses were the windows of the soul, and that the reason had a divine right to feed upon facts, and that it was the business of the faith to digest the strong meat of the toughest and most practical of pagan philosophies. It is a fact, like a military strategy of Napoleon, that Aquinas was thus fighting for all that is liberal and enlightened, as compared with his rivals, or for that matter his successors and supplanters. Those who, for other reasons, honestly accept the final effect of the Reformation will nonetheless face the fact and that it was the schoolman who was the reformer, and that the later reformers were by comparison reactionaries. I use the word not as a reproach from my own standpoint, but as a fact from the ordinary, modern, progressive standpoint. For instance, they riveted the mind back to the literal sufficiency of the Hebrew Scriptures. When St. Thomas had already spoken of the Spirit giving grace to the Greek philosophies, he insisted on the social duty of works, they only on the spiritual duty of faith. It was the very life of the Thomas teaching that reason can be trusted. It was the very life of Lutheran teaching that reason is utterly untrustworthy. Now when this fact is found to be a fact, the danger is that all the unstable opposition will suddenly slide to the opposite extreme. Those who up to that moment have been abusing the schoolmen as a dogmatist will begin to admire the schoolmen as a modernist who diluted dogma. They will hastily begin to adorn his statue with all the faded garlands of progress, to present him as a man in advance of his age, who is always supposed to mean in agreement with our age, and to load him with an unprovoked imputation of having produced the modern mind. They will discover his attraction, and somewhat hastily assume that he was like themselves, because he was attractive. Up to a point, this is pardonable enough. Up to a point, it has already happened in the case of St. Francis. But it would not go beyond a certain point in the case of St. Francis. Nobody, not even a freethinker like Renan or Matthew Arnold, would pretend that St. Francis was anything but a devout Christian, or had any other original motive except the imitation of Christ. Yet St. Francis also had that liberating and humanizing effect upon religion, though perhaps rather on the imagination than the intellect. But nobody says that St. Francis was loosening the Christian code, when he was obviously tightening it, like the rope around his friar's frock. Nobody says he merely opened the gates to skeptical science, or sold the pass to heathen humanism, or looked forward only to the Renaissance, or met the rationalists halfway. No biographer pretends that St. Francis, when he is reported to have opened the Gospels at random and read the great texts about poverty, really only opened the Aeneid and practiced the sword's virginalia out of respect for heathen letters and learning. No historian will pretend that St. Francis wrote the Canticle of the Sun in close imitation of a Homeric hymn to Apollo, or loved birds because he had carefully learned all the trick of the Roman augurs. In short, most people, Christian or heathen, would now agree that the Franciscan sentiment was primarily a Christian sentiment, unfolded from within, and out of an innocent, or if you will, ignorant, faith in the Christian religion itself. Nobody, as I have said, says that St. Francis drew his primary inspiration from Ovid. It would be every bit as false to say that Aquinas drew his primary inspiration from Aristotle. The whole lesson of his life, especially of his early life, the whole story of his childhood, and choice of career, shows that he was supremely and directly devotional, and that he passionately loved the Catholic worship long before he had found he had to fight for it. But there is also a special and clinching instance of which once more connects St. Thomas with St. Francis. It seems to be strangely forgotten that both these saints were in actual fact imitating a master who was not Aristotle, let alone Ovid. When they sanctified the senses or the simple things of nature, when St. Francis walked humbly among the beasts, or St. Francis debated courteously among the Gentiles. Those who miss the point of the religion, even if it be superstition. Nay, they miss the very point they would call most superstitious. I mean, the whole staggering story of the God-man in the Gospel. A few even miss it touching St. Francis and his unmixed and unlearned appeal to the Gospels. They will talk of the readiness of St. Francis to learn of the flowers of the birds as something that can only point onward to the pagan Renaissance. Whereas the fact stares them in the face, first that it points backward to the New Testament, and second that it points forward, if it points to anything, to the Aristotelian realism of the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas. They vaguely imagine that anybody who is humanizing divinity must be paganizing divinity without seeing that the humanizing of divinity is actually the strongest and starkest and most incredible dogma of the creed. St. Francis was becoming more like Christ, and not merely more like Buddha. He is considering the lilies of the field or the fowls of the air, and St. Thomas was becoming more of a Christian and not merely more of an Aristotelian. When he insisted that God and the image of God had come in contact through matter with the material world, these saints were, in the most exact sense of the term, humanists, because they were insisting on the immense importance of the human being in the theological scheme of things. But they were not humanists marching along a path of progress that leads to modernism and general skepticism. For in their very humanism, they were affirming a dogma now often regarded as the most superstitious superhumanism. They were strengthening that staggering doctrine of incarnation, which the skeptics find as hardest to believe. There cannot be a stiffer piece of Christian divinity than the divinity of Christ. This is a point that is here very much to the point, that these men became more orthodox when they became more rational or natural. Only by being thus orthodox can they be thus rational and natural. In other words, what may really be called a liberal theology was unfolded from within, from out of the original mysteries of Catholicism. But that liberality had nothing to do with liberalism. In fact, it cannot even now coexist with liberalism. Footnote: I use the word liberalism here in the strictly limited theological sense in which Newman and other theologians use it, in its popular and in its popular political sense, as I point out later. St. Thomas rather tended to be a liberal, especially for his time. The matter is so cogent that I will take one or two special ideas of St. Thomas to illustrate what I mean. Without anticipating the elementary sketch of Thomism that must be made later, the following points may be noted here.